Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, from Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's congressional address to Obamacare arguments at the Supreme Court, Washington is turning out lots of news this week, and we'll get an update.
First, a report released yesterday by the Department of Justice found sweeping patterns of racial bias within the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department. While the report only focused on Ferguson, some of the issues it raises are ones facing departments across the country.
The report comes the same week as new policing recommendations from a federal task force appointed by President Obama. But as police departments grapple with these complex issues, are we already starting to see a softer approach to policing across the country? And just how difficult is it for police to tackle some of the issues brought up in the Ferguson report?
Joining us now is Peter Moskos. He's an associate professor at the City University of New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's in the Department of Law, Police Science, and Criminal Justice Administration. He's also a former Baltimore City police officer. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So we've got these two reports, the Ferguson one and the policing one. There's going to be a lot of discussion in the coming weeks about how policing could or should change. But even before these came out, were you seeing changes from the police departments across the country when it came to these issues?
You do constantly see police departments trying to address these issues. A lot of the problem, though, is getting good ideas down through the rank and file officers. I mean, there's a matter of changing police culture, and that's a bit tougher to do than a presidential commission.
Is there in many departments a culture, pervasive racism is one of the phrases used in reference to Ferguson. Is this something unique to Ferguson, maybe a few other places, or is this an issue that we're grappling with all over the country?
I think it's less of an issue than a lot of people think it is. You know, I can't speak for Ferguson. I haven't been there. I don't know it. And maybe they got problems that are particularly bad. Well, they do have problems that are particularly bad. A lot of those problems don't just relate to police, though. They relate to the courts, and they relate to the democratic process or lack thereof. So in some ways, police are becoming the scapegoats for greater issues of race and poverty in America, which isn't necessarily fair to police. But I can't particularly, you know, I don't know the Ferguson Police Department. I do know the police department. I was in Baltimore City. I'm very familiar with the New York City Police Department. And my short answer is no, that the problem is not racism among police officers.
So if we see disparities, say, in arrests by race or police shootings by race, things like that, what do you point to as the problem if it's not something within the culture of policing?
Well, disparities in violent crime by race, and a lot of that is linked to poverty, but there are those disparities. I mean, the Department of Justice report, those numbers in and of themselves don't mean anything because we don't know, they're not telling us what the rate of violent crime is in Ferguson by rate. I mean, we do know, based on, unfortunately, not very good data, but, you know, the per capita, the odds of police officers getting killed by a black suspect are greater than the chance of police officers killing a black suspect. So there's some parity there. Now, this doesn't still, there are greater problems. Why do these disparities exist at all? But just to say cops are more likely to arrest black people doesn't mean anything without knowing other factors, specifically crime.
Do you see police officers as embattled, maybe unfairly, and that making it harder for them to do their jobs?
Well, the cops are always going to feel embattled, and you know, there's nothing cops like more than complaining. You know, the two things they complain about are change and the way things are. So to some extent, that's nothing new. And then, look, most of they're professionals, and they're going to go to work and do their job by and large. But that whole issue of we really have a sort of a, mostly, not so much in Madison necessarily, but you have a blue-collar police culture that is really now the weight of societies of hundreds of years of racial discrimination, of oppression, are sort of being placed on the backs of police officers. It's not quite clear what they're supposed to do. I mean, by and large, they're answering calls for service, and they're going to where those calls of service are. By and large, they're patrolling where violent crime is, which is, does then give you more traffic stops in minority neighborhoods, for instance. But that's not the individual officer saying, I'm just going out and trying to harass minorities.
Are there procedural changes that could be made at police departments, especially ones that deal with high crime areas, maybe areas with minority populations, that make the kind of headline-grabbing friction less likely to happen in the first place?
Yeah, probably. I mean, some of it is, of course, issues happen all the time. There are bad shootings from police towards blacks, their bad shootings towards whites, a lot of those don't make the news. So some of it is a matter of reporting, but absolutely there are things police can do. One of the best things would be to simply get out of the police car more. There should be less reliance on calls for service, which would be a pretty major change in the police department, but, you know, police managed just fine for their first 120 years of existence without the 911 system. But many times now you have police responding to sort of anybody who can pick up a phone. So the police becomes the armed state agent of an individual citizen's bad judgment or racism. So if you get cops out of cars more, give them a geographic beat, and once they get to know people and in that community, you'll find both a better attitude by police who aren't constantly just dealing with people having horrible days, but you also find better attitudes in the community once they get to know the police officer as a human being and realize what they're trying to do.
Now, this kind of neighborhood policing, we're hearing, I think more police departments make the case that they need more of that. Is that a trend nationwide?
No, they talk a good game. I mean, the problem is there are limited resources, and you have generally half of police departments are assigned to patrol, which means sitting in cars waiting for people to call the police department. At some point, we have to sort of de-sell the public that rapid response is essential to police service. I mean, we need it for firefighters. We need it for ambulances if you're having a heart attack. But police just don't get that many calls for crimes in progress so they can zip there quickly and arrest the offender. The focus has to be more on preventing crime. And part of that is getting to know who the players in the community are. And that is a problem sometimes if cops start to see everyone in a certain area, such as Ferguson, because, I mean, they're sort of documented, if police see everyone in a certain area as being part of a criminal class, because that's simply not true. But so to bridge that divide, the best thing you can do is try and get the police officer out of the police car.
Now, talking about a cultural change on the police side, you're talking about a big cultural change on the civilian side, the idea that, no, the main, you shouldn't be calling 911 to summon police unless there's a major crime already in progress.
Well, not even necessarily a major crime, certainly a minor crime, but I'm talking about, you know, my daughter won't go to school, my boyfriend's putting his feet in my hair, both of which are calls I actually received, or you just get calls for an armed person at a bus stop. Well, the person's not armed, but the cops are going to approach with their guns drawn. That is not the way to deal with these problems. I don't think the public realizes just what a large percentage of calls come into the police department, you know, for lack of a better word, by crazy people, reporting burglaries at addresses that don't exist. It's actually calling 911 and hanging up the phone. It's actually a pretty significant part of total call volume, and yet cops have to respond pretty much to each and every one of them.
And these are things where the police might enter the situation thinking that there is potentially danger in progress that maybe raises the risk, I guess, of a bad police-civilian interaction then.
Yeah, and also you have, and this is, I mean, when someone does call the police, generally the information then goes to two people, the operator and the dispatcher, before it goes to the police officer. So certainly from the organizational standpoint, you could devise a better system. Maybe have the caller speak directly to the cop, because often by the time that information gets to the police officer, some key information, like the caller saying, I think it's a toy gun, the cop doesn't get that information. And then you have fatal consequences sometimes.
Do you see any kind of change like that happening? It sounds like it might be a hard sell to the public to change the way 911 is used.
It would be a hard sell, but look, we sold it to the public in the 70s and 80s. We can slowly move. I mean, the public has to see something in return, and that would be, at least in sort of urban environments, would be knowing your beat officer, knowing a cop you can talk to. Often the issues that the public have aren't, you may not think are worthy of calling the cops, but if you know the officer, you can mention, you know, I see those kids hanging around the corner a lot. They're breaking bottles. It's not something maybe you'll call 911 about, but it's something that cops should know about. So the public would have to see something in return, but the idea that a cop is at your beck and call within, you know, 2 to 5 minutes when you pick up the phone, we know it doesn't work when you need it. And it's about, you know, half of police departments are dedicated to that. The other half, specialized units and headquarters and you know, various sort of light duty. But we could try. We could try. You know, Madison historically has had a very progressive police department, so you'd hope that some place like that could do this. There also are departments that simply do it better than other departments. Police shootings are very much related to levels of crime, but, you know, New York City, despite individual incidents that have happened, shoots very few people per capita. I mean, far less than cities like Albuquerque or Riverside, California. So there is a certain thing where you could have best practices. Now, I don't exactly know what they're doing right in New York, and this is the problem, and the system is so decentralized. But certainly there are departments with regard to use of force that we could use as an example. Another problem, if I could mention it, is cops today are trained to use force for compliance issues. And then when cops do that, when they mace or tase somebody because they didn't follow directions, that's horrible. They shouldn't be trained that way. Use of force should be for force situations, for threats. But that's not the way cops are trained today. So this is something where the public does need to say, you know what, we do have civilian oversight of police in this country. Sometimes it's a little hard to use that, but we simply don't want cops tasing people if they don't comply.
We'll leave it there for now. Peter, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Peter Moskos, associate professor at the City University of New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice, also a former Baltimore City police officer.
Washington is on fire this week. Yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke to Congress about the threat of Iran, and Congress managed to agree on Homeland Security funding after missing the deadline last Friday.
Also this week, the Supreme Court is hearing arguments over whether the federal government can give health care subsidies for people in states like Wisconsin that don't have their own exchanges, and Hillary Clinton's use of a personal email address for State Department business is being called a scandal.
Here with us to break it all down is USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time. Paul, good to have you back.
How you doing, Veronica?
Good, thanks. So we'll start with Netanyahu. Addressed Congress yesterday, spoke out against President Obama's negotiations with Iran on a nuclear agreement, calling it a bad deal. First of all, what is the precedent for this kind of address from a foreign leader at kind of a crucial time like this?
Well, I mean, it's obviously not all that unusual to have a foreign leader address a joint session of Congress. I think the joint meeting of Congress. It was not officially a session. I think what is unusual about this one is A, the timing. Mr. Netanyahu was invited to speak by Speaker John Boehner the day after President Obama gave his State of the Union address, asking Congress not to take any more action on sanctions against Iran and to give diplomacy some more time to do its work. And Obama, clearly has a different position on this than Netanyahu, and Boehner was inviting Netanyahu essentially to make the counter case. And there's a question about whether they sort of surprised the administration or whether they properly briefed the administration or consulted with the administration about inviting him. Those have all been pretty touchy issues. And a bunch of Democrats protested and didn't show up at the meeting because they thought that it was badly handled by Boehner and a poke in the eye to Obama.
And will a talk like that at a crucial time, will it have any political effect for President Obama? Does it put more heat on, or does it just make things more controversial and contentious?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to know what the political fallout of all this is. I mean, obviously, Republicans are trying to separate, from political purposes, the Republicans are trying to separate Democrats from Jewish voters in the United States and to try and make the case that they are the real allies of Israel. And the Democrats are kind of weak-kneed, led by President Obama, in their approach to Iran and their support of Israel. And I think you could make the case that this was a really good opportunity for them to make that point through this speech. On the other hand, I think you will also have some Democrats feeling that and arguing that the Republicans sort of overplayed their hand here and made it into turned foreign policy into a political debate and a partisan political debate, and that's generally considered bad form. At least that's what the Democrats would argue.
Well, some in Congress, mostly Republicans, want to pass sanctions in Iran now and that would end the president's negotiations. President Obama would veto that, but are they gaining enough ground to maybe override that veto?
It's hard to tell. At this point, they haven't even started a vote yet. They haven't really talked about exactly what bill they would look at. I did see an introduction of a bill today that is somewhat short of that. It would instead give Congress the authority to vote on any agreement that the president reaches with Iran. I'm not sure constitutionally how that works, but still, I have not yet seen a sanctions bill that they want to pursue. I have not yet seen them actually scheduling a vote, but it would not surprise me to see Congress vote on it anyway, for again the same purposes as we've talked about before. Sometimes in Congress you win even when you lose because you force your opponent to take a vote they don't want to take.
Well, moving on, there was a big game of chicken going on in Congress, and the House backed down, agreed to pass a Homeland Security funding through September without blocking funding for the president's immigration action. Can you put that into context for us? What does that mean for Republicans?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that was interesting about that is that the thing came to the floor a week ago and collapsed. The Speaker Boehner could not get enough Republicans to sign on to it. And the Democrats all refused to play along because he was going for a brief, I think it was a three-week extension at that point. And the Democrats said, this is silly, let's do the whole year. And so he came back with a whole year. And I think the takeaway message here is that Boehner pushed a year-long funding bill for the Department of Homeland Security, relying on Democrats to provide the bulk of the necessary votes, while a significant portion of the Republicans continued to vote against it in protest. So once again, you see this issue where the Speaker of the House is estranged from a significant portion of his own party. I think we will see this playing again and again throughout this Congress, where either bills just fall apart on the floor, or Speaker Boehner's going to have to work out some deals with the Democrats to get stuff he wants passed.
Right, and is there a bigger narrative there about a lack of cohesion among Republicans in the House and about a lack of unified mission moving forward, and also, I guess, about any sort of hope for bipartisanship? Or is that story about, you know, sort of disruption among Republicans overplayed?
I don't know. I mean, you could make the argument the other way around, that this actually ended up being a pretty bipartisan result, that both the Senate and the House agreed with you know, Democrats and Republicans voting together to pass a year-long spending bill without any kind of added riders overturning the president's immigration orders. I mean, that it ends up being a bipartisan vote. So you can argue that, well, this proves the various isolation and a fracture in the Republican Party. Yeah, maybe. But it also proves that sometimes you can legislate from the middle, as it were, and you lose people on both sides. You lose Republicans, you lose Democrats.
Right. Not everybody felt good about, though. It wasn't one where we both sides walked away feeling good at the end of the day.
No, everyone felt bad about it at the end of the day. But that's also sometimes proof of bipartisanship. Like, if you all walk away and say, oh, man, that tasted awful, but at least we ate it. I mean, you know, that's the sort of thing.
So was a shutdown just too big of a thing that no one, Republicans just didn't have the appetite for it?
Yeah, nobody really wanted to go there. I mean, even though there was an argument that it wouldn't have had a dramatic impact, at least in the short term, first of all, nobody wanted to go there. And second, there was no clear way out. Once you got there, you'd still face the same vote you faced this week. You'd still sooner or later have to fund DHS, and you weren't going to get it funded with these riders on because the president would veto them and the Senate wouldn't accept them.
Well, our last story today, Hillary Clinton's use of a personal email address to conduct State Department business was making pretty big headlines yesterday. And today, news that a House committee has said they're going to subpoena emails on this. How big is this thing going to get, do you think?
You know, I don't know. This is, keep in mind that in 2007, the Democrats in the House were attacking White House officials in the Bush administration for doing the same thing. And it went on for months. It was a full investigation by the Oversight Committee. It was a whole series of reports. It was, you know, allegations of wrongdoing. I mean, it became the narrative for more than a year. So I wouldn't be surprised to hear more of this. And again, this is an opportunity where, for Republicans, policy and politics merge. It's bad policy to be managing government affairs on a personal email account. We've now come to now laws that sort of make it clear that material needs to be collected. There were not at the time. So, it's bad policy, and Republicans make that point, but it also is good politics for them because they can make the point that Hillary Clinton was doing something secret, which, if she's going to run for president as a Democrat in 2016, that's good politics for the Republicans as well. So they get a nice sweet spot thing here. I expect to hear a lot more about this topic.
It's interesting that this particular story took so long to come out and that this reporter who made the request for the emails didn't do it until 2013, I think it was. Why now?
Well, you know, there has been some. In 2013, there apparently were some reports that these email accounts existed, so it wasn't the first time this has been reported on. And it comes out now for a couple of reasons. Not the least of it is that this Benghazi committee is now looking for some information and may or may not be getting these emails. And, of course, there's renewed attention to Hillary Clinton as she gears up for a run for the presidency. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that may be 3 or 4 or 5 years old that we wouldn't have written about 3 years ago, but we will now because it's suddenly in the heat of a political season. That's how the news works.
And Paul, just real briefly, the Supreme Court is hearing arguments today over whether the federal government can provide health insurance subsidies to people who live in states, Wisconsin included, that didn't set up their own ACA exchanges. How big a deal will this be?
It'd be huge. I mean, it would basically undermine the entire underpinning of the health care law. I mean, 8 million people would lose their funding for health insurance. So if the Supreme Court rules that way, it would really upset the apple cart for the Affordable Care Act, for better or worse, depending on your look. And I think even Republicans have sort of scratched their heads like, if this happens, we're going to have to figure out some way to help those people who are now suddenly without financial support for their health insurance.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Brenna. Talk to you soon.
We've been speaking with USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time to give us the latest from the Capitol.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Yesterday, in an open letter, Governor Walker said he would sign legislation that would ban abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy, and he expects a bill to land on his desk in the current session.
In addition to supporting abortion restrictions in Wisconsin, Governor Walker also said he'd support similar laws on the federal level. It's catching national attention as political onlookers keep tabs on Walker's possible presidential bid.
Now that the governor's position is known, how long until abortion legislation is introduced in the legislature? And for that, we turn to State Representative Andre Jacques of DePere. Representative Jacques says he's currently working on the abortion legislation that Governor Walker was likely referring to. Representative Jacques, thanks for joining us.
Well, good afternoon, Veronica. I'd actually like to correct you right off the bat. I think I've indicated that it's not actually legislation that I am drafting or am involved in the drafting of. I am aware that it is being drafted by my colleagues, and I certainly am supportive of it and certainly have checked into it, so I'm happy to talk about it.
Well, let's talk about that legislation that seems likely to come. You say you are not involved in the drafting of it. I apologize for that error, but what do you think the governor is looking to clarify here in terms of his position on abortion?
Well, certainly the governor is pro-life, and I certainly appreciate that myself, and I have been very involved legislatively in similar initiatives in the past. I think it's important to realize that what we're talking about is dealing with the pain-capable unborn children and really moving us into the 21st century where we have new and substantial medical evidence that shows us that unborn babies can feel pain. And so, you know, the 20 weeks, I think, is sometimes used in approximation, but it's very important to see that the science is going to move us in that direction in terms of the evidence showing that unborn children are capable of feeling pain at 20 weeks post-fertilization, if not earlier. So I believe the legislation, as I understand it, is going to state that if the Department of Health Services finds that unborn children can feel pain at an earlier point in development, then that age could be earlier than 20 weeks.
Now, the governor told Fox News Sunday that previous abortion legislation he signed left the ultimate decision between a woman and her doctor. Does this kind of bill take that away?
I don't believe so. You know, this is something where I think there are any number of protections that the governor has signed into law in terms of regulations, and you look at some of the things that we've worked on previously regarding hospital admitting privileges, or, you know, I think that the governor has a strong track record of being pro-life, and I think that he certainly would agree with that and has stated that, and, you know, I, you know, don't know that there's anything to my mind that has really changed in his approach to this issue, and I've known him for many years.
Should there be any exceptions to the restrictions in cases like these, for example, in cases of rape and incest or a mother's health?
Well, again, in those situations, what we have to focus on is, can the child feel pain? And in all those circumstances, they certainly are, and certainly you don't want the child to be punished for the actions of one of the parents. And You know, certainly we don't do that in our criminal justice system. I think that, you know, and certainly I have I've worked very strongly with the Coalition Against Sexual Assault and Coalition Against Domestic Violence on championing a number of their issues, and certainly feel very strongly that anybody who commits an act of violence should be immediately held accountable and for that. But this is a situation where, you know, I think in many cases there are even false exceptions in the situation where, under Wisconsin statutes, if you actually take a look at the way our statutes are constructed, it's not actually considered an abortion if it is not intended to be so. So any sort of a medical procedure or life-sustaining treatment which has the unintended secondary consequence of ending the life of the child is not considered an abortion under several of the definitions that are found in state statute.
There are a lot of budget issues facing Wisconsin right now, lots of things that are being discussed in the governor's budget, potential legislation coming down the pike. Why do you think the governor is choosing to talk about abortion and his willingness to move forward with something like this right now?
Well, you know, I'm not going to speculate on that or any number of the things that the governor has brought forward. Certainly, there are so many components to the state budget, and, you know, certainly I'm appreciative of those areas where the governor has indicated or brought forward language that I have introduced as standalone bills in the past that is going to have a helpful fiscal effect for the state. And there are certainly a number of areas where I'll seek improvements throughout the process, and that always happens. But as far as, you know, any particular announcement by the governor, he's certainly asked about his position on any number of pieces of legislation almost continuously. And I've always taken the approach that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. So it is something where, you know, it's not as if, you know, we are dealing with these issues in a vacuum. There are certainly many different items that are on the agenda that are being discussed all the time.
Would you support an abortion ban similar to the one the governor is talking about if the mother's health were at risk, maybe her life?
Well, again, I don't feel that such an exception is necessary. Certainly we've seen that a health exception in particular is very dangerous because there really is no, you know, nothing specific to that, it's a loophole big enough to drive a truck through. And there have been several abortionists who have certified that they will always be able to say that a woman's health is endangered in order to, you know, procure an abortion for her. So that's something that there's been testimony in Congress on. So, and if you look at the particular piece of legislation that we're talking about, which again, several other states have already brought forward, there is very strong national support, and I think state support as well, you know, depending on exactly how the question is phrased, between you know, anywhere north of 50% to close to 65% of people who would support that legislation, not including those who are undecided. So, you know, again, if you look at anything called the life of the mother exception is in many ways throughout the movement considered a false exception because, again, there are those, including past surgeon generals, who have indicated that abortion is never necessary to save the life of the mother. In fact, an abortion is going to increase jeopardy to the mother's health, as well as those that will, as I did earlier, point out that in the medical context and even in the religious context, it's not considered an abortion to have a legitimate medical procedure meant to save the life or even, in many cases, improve the health. So, for instance, a situation where there might be cancer treatment or an ectopic pregnancy, any of those common exceptions that people might bring up, those aren't actually considered exceptions in the sense that anything would actually even need to be written in. I mean, it's almost more of a redundancy within the law because it's not considered an abortion, at least for reporting purposes, if it's something where the actual abortion itself, or it's not really an abortion, but the death of the unborn child results from the unintentional consequence of a legitimate medical procedure.
Now, the governor has supported tweaks to this, including doctors having admitting privileges and requiring an ultrasound, and ran into some legal blocks on some of that. Are you expecting similar issues with legislation like this?
Well, I think just in general, any legislation that we pass in Madison that isn't nearly unanimous, and even for some that almost are, we just automatically assume that there are going to be some legal challenges by those who are opposed to the legislation. So I would certainly expect that that will happen. There's been what I consider to be venue shopping in our court system, really looking for favorable judges in this case, or the case that you just cited. It was the most recent federal judge in the state appointed by President Obama. So certainly his initial ruling was not at all surprising. And we've seen that in other jurisdictions as well. But this is something that I believe is in effect in 9 of the 10 states that it has passed. In the one situation where it has not, it has no effect at all to the substance of the, it's not related to the substance of the bill. The reason why the legislation is not in effect, it's dealing with, I believe, a situation where the bill is trying to make be made retroactive, which just in general, I will tell you, you know, we work on any number of pieces of legislation. Particularly, I've done quite a bit in the criminal justice system relating to, and as past chair of the Public Safety Committee for the Assembly, there's a temptation when you see a situation that is unfortunate in state law that can be remedied by changing the criminal justice situation, just as we have seen earlier this year dealing with the upskirting laws that many states are currently addressing, to make those laws retroactive. And legally, you just can't do that. You have to, for the most part, make that prospective. So, again, I don't even see in that state it necessarily being a significant situation from the standpoint of many times bills are severable to the point that something like a retroactivity clause cannot be considered. But, you know, certainly I think that this is constitutional and something that, you know, has been upheld, will be upheld as a legitimate regulation under the Constitution.
Representative Jacques, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Andre Jacques, a Republican state representative from De Pere, talking about a proposed bill he supports which would ban abortions for most women after 20 weeks in pregnancy.
Coming up, we get a response from Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. The group says they would challenge this legislation in court if it passes.
We're continuing our conversation about possible abortion restrictions in Wisconsin. We just heard from State Representative Andre Jacques, who supports legislation that would ban abortions for most women after 20 weeks of pregnancy.
Now we hear from Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. The group says it would oppose these restrictions in court.
Nicole Safar is with us now. She's the Public Policy Director at Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. Nicole, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, did you have any indication that legislation aimed at restricting abortion was on the way?
Yes. We have seen a lot of abortion restrictions in Wisconsin over the last 4 years, and certainly it is well known that Governor Walker, one of his priorities is to make abortion illegal in our state.
And where do you stand on the coming legislation based on what's out there so far? We've heard this 20 weeks number, but the exact wording and technicalities, that's not known.
Well, at Planned Parenthood, we really strive every day to make sure that our patients receive high quality, compassionate, and non-judgmental care. Abortion is a deeply, deeply personal issue, and it's often a complex decision for a woman and her family. We know that when life's most trying and important decisions happen, that women and their families are the ones who know what's best and politicians don't. So we would adamantly oppose a restriction that bans abortion and takes a medical decision away from a woman, her doctor, and her family.
Now, Governor Walker said in his open letter that he wants to, and this is a quote, protect both mother and child. And to zoom in on the mother aspect of this, Representative Jacques indicated that looking at, you know, issues of making exceptions for a mother in case of threatened health, it was a pretty big loophole and one that he wasn't prepared to say he would, you know, grant. What would you say to that?
Well, again, at Planned Parenthood, patient safety is our number one priority. Every day, our doctors and nurses are working to provide high quality, compassionate, safe care to women in Wisconsin. And it really is something that medical experts know the best about. Medical experts like the American Medical Association and the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists oppose bills like this, and they're concerned with women's safety. Obviously, they're the ones who make the recommendations to OBs all across the country on what the best standards of practice are. So I really defer to these medical experts, and what they say is abortion bans like the one Representative Jock supports really threaten women's health. They force women to travel, sometimes states away, to places where they can get the care. And we have to remember, this is making a medical procedure illegal. This is putting criminal penalties on a physician, preventing them from providing what in some cases is needed care. And that really chills a doctor's ability to provide appropriate individualized care for each patient.
In his letter, Governor Walker also highlighted how he defunded Planned Parenthood. How has that impacted your organization so far?
Yeah, the defunding has been a big blow to Planned Parenthood. We lost state funding in 8 of our rural health centers, and since 2012, we have unfortunately had to close 5 of those health centers. So there are over 3,000 women in the state of Wisconsin, in places like Fond du Lac and Beaver Dam and Chippewa Falls, that no longer have a community-based healthcare center to go for cancer screenings and birth control. And that is really untenable, and we can't imagine why. Well, we know that not everybody is going to agree on abortion. It's just unbelievable that we can't agree that all women should have high quality, affordable access to cancer screenings in their town.
And turning back again to this particular proposed piece of legislation, it hasn't even been proposed yet, it's being written, but presuming that abortion legislation, like we've been discussing, gets passed and gets signed, what impact would that have on women here in Wisconsin?
Well, the first impact that it would have is that a woman who is grappling with this decision, who might find out at 20 weeks into her pregnancy that her health is severely at risk, that her blood pressure is so high that continuing the pregnancy really threatens her life, she wouldn't have any medical options in Wisconsin. She would have to go to Chicago or Minneapolis or somewhere else, and she'd be forced to travel in that sort of risky health situation. And again, that's just, even if it's only 20 women or 100 women, because the vast, vast majority of abortions in Wisconsin do happen well before 20 weeks. But even if it is just a small number of women, that devastating impact is too much, I think, for our state legislature to put on the women in this state.
Now, looking at the political side of this for just a moment, you were quoted in the media as saying that the governor took a public position on abortion as a distraction from the budget. But some Republicans have said that they've wanted this kind of legislation for a while. Does that change your thinking here?
You know, I think that this has certainly been on the priority list for a while. As I alluded to earlier, there have been many abortion restrictions passed in the last 4 years. And this is, you know, one of the sort of last big ones, I think, that has been on their agenda. But with everything else that's happening with all of the discussion in the extraordinary session about taking workers' voices away from the negotiating table, with the big cuts to the UW system and K-12, all of this stuff that's happening, it seems, I think, at the very least, unusual to be adding a whole other big issue into the discussion when we're really grappling in this state with some tough things.
Now, we're early into the governor's term here. Do you expect to see other types of legislation affecting reproductive issues coming up, especially given some of the Republican majorities in the legislature?
Absolutely. I mean, we are always on watch to see what else can happen. The reality is that Planned Parenthood and access to women's health care, not just abortion services, but sort of the full range of reproductive health services, has been a huge target for Governor Walker and the Republican leadership, and they use it to score political points. They really have no qualms putting women's health into the political realm, and it's something that you know, we've seen happen time and time again. So I do expect more, but I expect that the voters in the state and the constituents all across the state believe in the values that Planned Parenthood believes in, the most of them, and we can agree that while abortion maybe isn't, we wouldn't all make the same decision about abortion, that women are the ones to know what's best for them and their families.
And Nicole, just very briefly, what sort of legal challenge would you expect to see to legislation like this?
You know, it's hard to say without looking, having the exact language and knowing how the law is going to play out. I think it's really hard to know. But again, I think the access issue is what's most important, and making sure that when a woman has to make a difficult medical decision, she gets all of the information, she has all of the options laid out by her physician, and really it comes down to what she feels is best.
Nicole, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Nicole Safar, Public Policy Director at Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. We also talked with State Representative Andre Jacques, who will be supporting a bill that restricts abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. Some big news from the world of science following up on a conversation we had yesterday on the show. David Johansen was with us. He's the researcher who discovered Lucy, the 3.2 million-year-old fossil remains of an early pre-human ancestor.
He told us there's going to be some big news coming out today. He couldn't talk about it yesterday, but here it is. A fossil jaw and teeth from the same region of Ethiopia as Lucy have been dated about 2.8 million years ago, classified as part of the Homo habilis species. That puts the rise of the genus Homo, that's our early peeps, way earlier than previously thought.
The research was released today by the journal Science, and one of the authors said it's the first fossil we have on the branch that leads towards us.
And Johansen himself was quoted by NBC saying he's not ready to call this a missing link exactly, but he says the new research is closing the gap between his discovery, Lucy, and the earlier members of the genus Homo.
It's nice to get the scoop today. Donald Johansen, a little bit cagey. Mm-hmm. He was embargoed yesterday.
Right.
We didn't get to talk about it. So it's good to get the news today. And I'm sure he's got a lot to chew on, along with a lot of other paleoanthropologists.
Yeah, I'm going to get the shovel and head out to the backyard.
Good luck.
Actually, I don't think we have any ancestors in Wisconsin going back quite that far.